Case number 21-5948, Corey Tarvin versus Jerry Lindemuth et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Michael Jules Brown for the appellant may proceed.
Thank you. And may it please the court, Michael Brown along with my colleague Tess Foley, on behalf of plaintiff appellant Corey Tarvin, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The district court abused discretion by dismissing a legally blind individual's lawsuit after one set of defendants did not receive responses to written interrogatories. This is not a case where Mr. Tarvin was stubbornly disobedient.
Do we know, it seems to be some question about this, did the Tennessee Department of Corrections get their responses to the discovery?
Your Honor, that's not in the district court record, but I do understand the representation from the state on appeal that they did on August 12th receive the responses to their discovery. And as Mr. Tarvin explained in several of his letters to the court, he responded to both discovery at the same time. CoreCivic never received theirs, but the state did receive their responses, and they concede that
so
in their briefs.
So this case, I'm curious about the, I understand your client's legally blind and has issues, right. And obviously, but in and the way I read the two handwritten letters, or maybe it was the handwritten one of them and the notice of appeal, he did attempt to put them, or did put them in the mail, or had somebody put them in the mail. One party got it, the other party didn't. But it seems to me that he attempted to comply with the discovery regardless of his handicap. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. So on August 23rd.
So this is a case that's, I guess it's more like a case where I find it hard to believe then that there's any, I assume you would agree, that there's bad faith or willfulness if the argument is I tried to comply and for whatever reason it gets lost in the mail. Is that right?
We absolutely agree, Your Honor. This is not one of those cases where Mr. Tarvin has abandoned his case, right? He has tried repeatedly to participate in the ways in which he is able. And if we look at the standard under Rule 41 in the first factor for fault, right, what's needed is being perverse in resisting authority, being stubbornly disobedient. You need an intent to thwart judicial proceedings or reckless disregard for the effect of plaintiff's conduct. And here you have Mr. Tarvin trying repeatedly in a way he is able to participate in his case. The district court erred first.
I mean, let's go back to that for a second, because I think, I mean, obviously we have a four-factor test.
Yes.
One of which is bad faith, willfulness, or fault.
Correct.
And the district court didn't find bad faith. It specifically said willfulness or fault, right? Or fault.
Correct.
What about, I'm not sure, we do have this other language that suggests that maybe as an overarching concept, dismissal is just not appropriate unless it's contumacious or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Does that elevate the first factor over the other three? Or, I mean, how do we work the factors in with this kind of overarching concept of kind of contumaciousness or track record of not complying?
Courts have said that the first factor of fault is the most important, but all four do matter. And it's our opinion that the district court erred on all four factors. But you also don't need to agree with us on all four factors in order to reverse, right? We see, for example, in the Carpenter case where it's less than all four factors and still a reversal. And the district court here relied on Hatcher v. Dennis to say, even if no bad faith, to go to your question, Judge Albanian, the failure to respond to discovery and a motion to compel constitutes fault. But in Hatcher, the plaintiff there, right, missed the motion to dismiss deadline, didn't respond to a subsequent show cause order without a single filing, right? So one of those cases where there's a complete abandonment of claims, that's not what you have here. Mr. Tarvin is repeatedly trying to participate in his case.
In any of those cases, did the client fire his lawyer?
So there are cases in which there's a breakdown in the relationship between the lawyer and the client before you get to the Rule 41 stage, but the question here is whether Mr. Tarvin's conduct, once he became pro se.
Well, I don't think that's right. I mean, we have to look at the case as a whole. Imagine you're the district judge. You get this complaint. You have a defendant who claims to be legally blind and has been abused in prison. You quite naturally think, I'm going to appoint that lawyer, that client counsel, which the district court judge did. He acknowledged expressly in his order that he was appointing the lawyer because the client was blind and couldn't prosecute the case on himself. He didn't appoint any lawyer. He appointed a partner at a Nashville law firm, Brandstetter Stranch Law Firm, a very well-known law firm. The lawyer represents the client for 2 years, twice amends the complaint for the client, but the client starts complaining about the lawyer and is calling and texting at night. I mean, sort of invasive. We've all been lawyers, but you get calls sometimes at night, but a lot of calls, files ethical complaints, complains to the court, and the lawyer moves naturally to withdraw. So the district court has tried to solve, the district court recognizes this problem. This defendant's gonna have a tough time litigating this, or this plaintiff's gonna have a tough time litigating the case on his own, appoints a lawyer for him to solve all the problems. It does that for 2 years until the client makes, as far as I can tell, unfounded complaints. There's been no finding by anyone that this lawyer violated ethical rules, correct?
Yeah, there has been no finding, and we do understand.
So basically fires the lawyer. So the district court thinks he's got the problem solved, and the client fires the lawyer after 2 years of very adequate, if not better, representation. And then the client starts missing deadlines. But and we're only reviewing that decision for an abuse of discretion, that the district judge, after having done this for the client for 2 years, realizes that the client has fired the lawyer, has been quite difficult, doesn't get another lawyer, doesn't retain another lawyer, misses deadlines, and that all, in my mind, could be considered as part of the first factor in the analysis.
So, Your Honor, respectfully, the decision not to reappoint counsel is not on appeal, and it cannot be that once Mr. Tarvin has the breakup with his lawyer, he's expected to operate as a non-disabled litigant. But say we follow the question, and you fault Mr. Tarvin for the breakup with the attorney that leads to maybe the missed interrogatory responses. The fault that we're looking at here is that CoreCivic never received the responses to interrogatory.
That's a different. I mean, that's the point Judge Nalbandian didn't ask you about, right, at the beginning. I mean, this is a different point. But assuming the client's missing deadlines, it seems to me the district court has within its power the right to say, I'm going to dismiss this case without prejudice. You can refile it, but by the way this case has been litigated, it's not going to be successfully done, largely due to the difficulties imposed by the plaintiff. And your response is the violations weren't. Is your response the violate? Are you disagreeing with anything I said, or is your response basically these were foot faults, and the district court shouldn't have cared about them?
So even if the district court had cared and brought into the
obviously it did care, but.
Sure, but in the fault analysis, we don't see a further recitation of the breakup with the lawyer. We don't see that weighing into the district court's fault decision. But even if the district court had taken that,
the district court was quite well aware of how this case proceeded.
But still, for example, even though it's an abuse of discretion standard, we see, for example, in the Patterson case where this court has said a 4.5-month delay in response interrogatories plus failing to submit a pretrial statement doesn't rise to the level.
I know, but it doesn't have the history this case did, where the district court did. I mean, the district court did what I think any district court would do in this circumstance. It tried to solve the problem. It did solve the problem for 2 years until the client recreated the problem.
But then under the Rule 41, Your Honor, respectfully, the question is whether Mr. Tarvin's conduct rose to the level.
I would consider Mr. Tarvin basically fired his lawyer by filing unfounded ethical complaints and complaining to the court about his lawyer, there's nothing in the record to suggest the lawyer wasn't doing anything but an A-plus job in the case.
And so the way in which we read this court's precedent in Patterson and also some of the district court decisions, for example, in Johnson and in Swanson, even if you have, right, so those two events, you have a breakup with a lawyer and then a missed interrogatory responses, still doesn't show a true pattern of contumacious conduct, right? Still doesn't rise to the level of being stubbornly disobedient or perverse in resisting authority. So even if you fully fault Mr. Tarvin for that breakup and then the interrogatories, understand that that might be something that he is to be blamed for, but does not rise to the level of fault, right?
Excellent question. So Mr. Tarvin complains that he, regularly or consistently requested that the facility provide him some sort of an accommodation, someone to help him completion of these various responses and other documents.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that reflects whether that happened? Maybe there are some volunteer inmates who helped along the way, but was he given any sort of help, or maybe that doesn't ordinarily happen, but I'm just wondering what the record reflects.
Sure. The best place to look for this is Record Entry 138 and Record Entry 140. Mr. Tarvin explains that over his time, he has been requesting assistance. He's occasionally been able to garner assistance from his mom, by placing phone calls from calling the court clerk, which is how he found out that CoreCivic did not receive his interrogatories, and by asking the facility for the assistance, Judge Cole, that you are referring to, and he gets sporadic assistance. In fact, that's exactly why he's suing. And it cannot be that his case gets thrown out for not having the assistance for which he is suing. So what happens is he's able to garner occasional assistance. That's how he responded to the discovery. But he explains, particularly in 138 and 140, that he's not getting that consistent assistance and that he wants to participate orally. He tries repeatedly to reach out to defense counsel, to the court, to say, I'm legally blind. Can I please respond to these interrogatories orally? Can I sit for an additional deposition? Right? He's trying actively to participate in his case. And so even if you fault him for the breakup of the attorney, even if you fault him for CoreCivic not getting the responses that he wrote, he's actively trying to show up and litigate in the best way in which he is able.
But and he is responding. I mean, it's kind of, he did file 138 and 140. I mean, he filed these other frivolous motions, you know, at the same time. I mean, he's clearly engaging in the court judicial process. So why isn't that evidence that he's basically just, you know, blowing off the discovery but filing other motions?
So respectfully, he is trying to participate, and what you see in each of those filings is an attempt to get before the court, but not direct responses to what's happening in the litigation, right? And what he's saying is, I can't read and then respond. I can write, right? He learned to write before he lost his vision. So he can scratch out letters to the court, right? And occasionally get assistance to type letters. But what he can't do is read the interrogatories and respond without the assistance for which he is suing.
That's a good argument, but where do we get that from? Just reading 138 and 140?
Well, particularly on August 23rd, and I believe it's record entry 140, and you can also look at the August 20th letter, which is record entry 138, where he says, I only knew CoreCivic was missing the discovery because I called the court clerk. Right? He's reaching out to the court to say, what's going on? Can I please get an update? I'm not avoiding the litigation. And the court clerk says, by the way, did you know that CoreCivic hasn't received your discovery? And then he tries to reach out to Attorney Tilley.
Let me ask you this. What would a remedy look like for you in this case?
Remedy in terms of from this court, we'd ask for a complete reversal and a remand so Mr. Tarvin can continue his
So we
litigation.
Would vacate the order and send it back, and then are you going to represent him below, or is he pro se still, or how's that going to work?
I realize I'm out of time. May I respond?
Oh, yeah.
So, Your Honor, we are engaged for the appeal, right? If it goes back and Mr. Tarvin gets to pick up this litigation, which he's been litigating since 2018, survived PLRA review and survived two motions to dismiss, right? So if he's able to pick that up, he is certainly excited and willing to pick up the litigation in a way that he is able. He's looking for district court counsel, and we certainly would hope that he is represented and try to work with him to make sure he can be represented there.
Is there any precedent for this idea that if I can't, that I can respond to interrogatories orally? The accommodations that he was asking for. Have we ever said that's, you know, abuse of discretion or something if you don't allow that?
So, not necessarily an abuse of discretion if the court doesn't allow that, right? So the conduct is not what the court should have done, but whether Mr. Tarvin's conduct rises to the level of Rule 41, and we don't think it is. What there is in other cases, right, we're not saying this was necessarily required here, but you do see courts dealing with, for example, visually impaired inmates under the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act giving oral orders on tape CDs or ordering assistance. So there are things that can help and make sure that even if he's not appointing counsel, he can litigate.
And I realize your time is up, but his argument is that I did respond to this discovery, right? So regardless of his handicaps, regardless of what happened, he sent the Tennessee Department of Corrections, and they presumably have in their file somewhere, and I don't know if it's in the record, but obviously it's not because we wouldn't have this dispute about it, but they've got a copy of his responses, right? So he could, but, you know, he could do that again, I take it, right?
So, Your Honor, the Tennessee Department certainly did get their responses, and they admit that in their appellate briefing. They're not here today. And certainly under the prejudice prong, there was an abuse of discretion in dismissing as to both parties and not just CoreCivic. But in terms of sort of doing it again, and we understand the department made this argument in their brief that he could just copy his responses. What he has said repeatedly is that he doesn't have consistent assistance to be able to do so. So he tried once, they didn't get to CoreCivic, and he said then after talking to the clerk, how else can I participate? I can't myself read them. I'm suing for the assistance. Can I please sit for a deposition? If you look at the 8 interrogatories that were served, right, what grievances have you filed? What are the facts of your case? These are questions that can be answered in a deposition. And he repeatedly is saying, how can I do that? That's not contumacious conduct. That's not fault. And for the other reasons in our briefing, we don't think the other factors
are that well. Before you sit down. Oh, go ahead.
I just have a question about the saving statute.
So
the
absolutely.
The complaint was dismissed without prejudice. Where does that leave Mr. Tarvin in terms of the ability to refile the complaint? Is that discretionary part of the court, whether to allow a complaint to be refiled? Can he file that as a matter of right? What's the situation?
Yeah, so it would be whether or not the court actually applies the saving statute. And as we argue in our briefing, the court and the motion to compel are silent on the statute of limitations issue. And the statute of limitations on not only the 1983 claim, but the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act claims as well, had run. And if you look at the case law that was around at the time, it was speculative as to whether the saving statute actually would have applied to Mr. Tarvin's claims, right? We have this court's decision in Bowles not applying the Ohio saving statute to a 1983 claim, which contrasted to this court's earlier 1972 decision in Moore, where the Tennessee saving statute was upheld. And as Northcutt out of the Middle District of Tennessee advises.
Ask you a related question. Why can't he refile a case with, I think you're saying there's continuing violations, like he's still not getting the help he needs. So why can't he file a new case? Maybe some old claims are foreclosed, maybe they're not, but I think he's got basically the same range of claims that are gonna fall within any limitations period. Why can't he file a new case if we affirm?
So respectfully, Your Honor, the reason why he can't, and the ADA and Rehabilitation Act claims, right, certainly some continuing violations there, and what he desperately wants is to be moved to the Lowy DeBerry Special Needs Facility where he'll get the accommodations that he needs. But he was brutally attacked in 2017, and that was the original impetus for his complaint in 2018, right? And he has sought monetary damages from the state and from CoreCivic for that brutal assault. And so he has constitutional claims for that assault, and that wouldn't be continuing, right? The statute of limitations would have run.
At worst, he may lose a claim or two, but he would be able to file a new case and assert many of these same claims, which would be within the limitations period.
I would argue some of the same claims, but not the ones related to the assault, which are certain.
And because it seems to me if two things happens. Either he gets a lawyer, it would be great thank you for taking this appointment. That's very helpful to our court. Hopefully he gets a lawyer, in which case he probably prosecutes the case, or he doesn't get a lawyer, and probably the same things happen again. I mean, that's the track record. So
we would hope, Your Honor, that he would be able to still participate pro se, right? If he gets some of those accommodations that we see in other cases.
It's not really the timing. It's not the limitations period that it really is a holdup here. It's him being able to actually litigate, which he proved he couldn't do without a lawyer, and he could do with a lawyer.
One point in addition to the 2017 claim on your question, Your Honor, he's been litigating this case since 2018, right? He survived PLRA review. He survived 2 motions dismissed. So,
yeah,
frankly,
I have a question. During that time, did he miss any deadlines while he had a lawyer?
While he had a lawyer, we do not understand that he missed any deadlines.
And that's why he successfully fended off all the things, all the motions you're talking about.
Not on the PLRA review, right? So that we understand the court independently took his first complaint, said you have a meritorious claim here, and then he gets appointed a lawyer, and then he makes it through the motion to dismiss briefing. But even if you don't follow us on the statute of limitations, right, this court's November decision in Allen and the Southern District of Ohio decision in Cox, right, both stand for the proposition that a dismissal without prejudice is, I'm sorry, an extreme and unwarranted sanction, right? And so even if you don't by the statute of limitations argument, which we certainly think the lower court abused its discretion on, without prejudice is still too harsh of a sanction here.
Again, is there a sanction you think the district court should have, what is there a lower sanction you think the district court should have entered?
The lower sort sanction, at least that we think the district court should have looked at, was the sanction that was applied in the Bank One of Cleveland case, which this court decided in 1990, where it limited discovery that the plaintiff could take until the plaintiff propounded the discovery responses that were being needed. So we think the district court could have said, Mr. Tarvin, you're prohibited from pursuing your own discovery until you get these responses, whether orally or with written assistance to CoreCivic. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Addie Brown and I represent Appalese CoreCivic, Matthew Corkum, and Chris Jackson in this case. As appellant discussed, there's only one issue here, and it's whether the district court abused its discretion in dismissing the case without prejudice for failing to comply with the court order. The parties also agree on the law to be applied here. We're looking at Rule 41B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The district court properly dismissed this action due to the appellant's failure to obey their order and certainly did not abuse its discretion in doing so.
Can you help us understand the factual backdrop? Judge Nalbandian asked about this. So Mr. Tarvin missed two deadlines with respect to CoreCivic. Missed the original discovery deadline, missed the motion to compel deadline.
Correct.
Were there any other deadlines that he missed?
Those were the two deadlines that he missed. Of course, after he fired his counsel.
Established, yeah.
Right.
And did he respond to discovery properly from the that served by the state?
He responded to their discovery. He took their typed discovery and hand wrote his answers on there. He skipped some of them. He didn't answer all of them, but he answered most of them and sent them to the TDOC, which is our position that if he had done just that with us, it would have survived a motion to dismiss.
But he says in his statements, I mean, I guess I'm curious about whether he missed the deadlines or not. He files or he writes out R-138 and R-140 before the motion to compel, before the compel deadline, right? I mean, August 31 is dated some day prior to the 27th. Why are they not responsive? They're not the discovery, but they're explanations for why they haven't received their discovery. I mean, he says, I put it in the mail. How is that bad faith? I mean, it's responsive, isn't it?
I don't think it's responsive to the discovery request. And then in response to that, counsel sent him another letter saying, we have not received your responses. Please submit your responses. And he still did not do so. And then even after the order...
But is it a response for me to say, if opposing counsel calls me and says, where's my discovery? And I say, I put it in the mail. That's a response, right? I mean, it's not... At some point, we have to figure out what happened, and we generally would just say, send me another copy. In this case, it's a little more complicated, I suppose, than that, according to what he's saying, because I'm not sure he's got a copy, he doesn't have a copy, or who knows, whatever. But isn't that responsive? I mean, this doesn't look to me like a case where somebody is just completely dilatory in responding to discovery. I mean, it's slow, it's not perfect, but it sounds like one party got it, the other party didn't. That suggests to me that there's not bad faith or fault going on. It's somebody got it and somebody didn't.
Correct. And he was told afterwards that we did not receive the responses and that he needed to respond and still did not do so, even after that. Even after the motion to compel was granted, he still did not submit any discovery requests. He reached out, we sent him another letter. He still did not submit responses. Even
did he call the attorney Tilley? I mean, was that a conversation that occurred?
It's not a conversation that occurred. He may have tried to call the office. I don't know. He claims that he did, but that's not a conversation that actually occurred. Whether he called, I couldn't tell you that. But of course, he claims in his letters, it's in the record, and he claims that he did, but it wasn't a conversation that attorney Tilley had with him.
But don't you think the district court doesn't mention either one of those handwritten notes, as I recall, in the opinion, or especially in the question about whether there's willfulness or fault. Why isn't an abuse of discretion to not consider those quote-unquote responses? I understand they may not be perfect, but shouldn't the court have at least grappled with them?
I think, Your Honor, that the district court was aware of the conduct that had taken place up until this point, and they see that he's continually not responding to this discovery, and so whether they took those notes into account or not, it still amounts to dilatory conduct.
Tarvin would have had to, Tarvin presumably would have presented that argument in some fashion to the district court. Did he present that argument in any way?
Not that I'm aware of. He didn't, his response to the order that came down granting our motion to compel was, I can't respond to anyone or anything, which on its face is an argument that he is visually impaired and can't respond. But if you look at that, he got the order and he knew the contents of it because the order says you need to respond, and his response is, well, I can't respond. So he, you know, he had the notice, which is another prong, prong three that we're talking about, whether he had notice that he needed to respond. And
well, but he says, I mean, I suppose their argument will be in 138, or maybe it's 138, maybe it's 140, he says that he called the clerk of the court, and the clerk said, or somebody in the judge's chambers, who knows, I don't know, but said something like, the defendants haven't received their discovery or something. That I don't know that he, and but he also says that he has trouble with the mail. So I'm not sure that he necessarily received the, like, the hard copy of the order. We don't know, do we? I mean, it was surely it was sent to him, and I suppose it's implausible that he wouldn't have seen a copy of it. But it, his own words are, I didn't find out until I called the court. So, right. I mean, I'm not, is that the same thing as kind of getting notice of the order in the mail? I don't know.
Respectfully, Your Honor, what we believe the order of events to have happened was that the call to the clerk of the court was while our motion to compel was pending, but before it was granted. So he gets the order that says you have to respond, and then he says, well, I can't respond to it. So his letters to the court amounted to a response to that order. And I think, you know, when we're talking about...
Were there any complaints made by Tarvin while he had a lawyer that he was having a problem with the mail system?
No, Your Honor. Not that we're aware of. Not that are in the record. I think when we're talking about the mail, too, we have to remember that this appeal is based on the fact that he could not respond. The fact that he was having trouble with the mail at one point in time is at issue, but the main point here that appellant is trying to make is that he was unable to respond. He couldn't respond because of his vision limitations, and he proved that he could. He could respond because he did to TDOC's discovery requests.
Well, that's the right, and that's what confuses me. I don't think this is the original response is not an inability to respond, because taking him at his word, he did respond. He had two sets of discovery. He put them, somebody put them both in the mail. Some, one party got them, the other party didn't. The inability comes in, I suppose, later when the motion to compel is filed and the motion to dismiss is filed and all, you know, other things are filed, and he says, well, I can't respond to all that. But he did, he did respond at some point because the Department of Corrections got a response. So he is clearly capable of responding, or at least was capable of responding. But I guess that cuts both ways, because in my mind, it cuts against him because he's able to respond. So I don't know that that's a great argument. But on the other hand, his response is, I did respond to the discovery. I tried to respond, and that, to me, that's not the same thing as dilatory conduct. If it gets lost in the mail, that's not my fault. It's, we should work it out. It's unfortunate, and like I said before, normally I would just go grab another copy and email it to you, but that's not possible here. So I don't know, but again, I don't know how that's willfulness. It's, he did respond, right? Or tried to respond.
He responded to TDOC's discovery request. These are two separate sets of discovery.
Right, but what I'm saying is that according to what he says, they were both put in the mail at the same time, right? I mean, he's saying, that's what he's saying. I don't, and the district court doesn't say anywhere, I don't believe, we have cases where, you know, the district court will say, I don't believe you, or I find your responses to be incredible, whatever that one case was. And so it's like a credibility determination. I don't believe what you're saying, but I don't think the district court says that here. There is no kind of credibility determination. It's that I don't believe that you fill them out and put them in the mail. So I guess there are two different sets of discovery, but again, what he says is they were both put in the mail at the same time. I don't know why you didn't get yours.
Right.
I'm struggling to figure out where the fault is in that.
I think that the fault, Your Honor,
without a credibility determination. It may well be that there's a credibility determination that would be different, but without that, I'm not sure why that's fault.
Right. I think, Your Honor, that when we're looking at this, we have to look at the fact that maybe he did put his, taking him at his word, as you said, he did put his discovery responses in the mail and we did not receive them. But then we send letters, we follow up. He says he didn't, he tells us that. We send him another letter. We still don't get any responses. The court issues an order saying you have to respond in X amount of days. Still don't get a response. But instead of responding to that, he sends letters to the court. He sends out these things proving that he is able to do so. He's able to send these letters. He's able. So we're either arguing about, you know, whether he put the responses in the mail, whether that's, you know, contumacious, or whether he was unable to. Those two things are different, because if he is able, this court finds that he is able to respond, then that moots all these other prongs that he was warned. I mean, if he was able, say he's able to get these letters and read them and respond to them, then he was able to get the court's order granting the motion to compel and understand that it was, he had to respond in X number of days. So we're looking at, you know, was he able to respond and did not, or was it a mail issue? He is proving over and over that, you know, he's sending a lot of things out to the court, to counsel. There are lots of letters to counsel that we have that are not in the record because they were never filed. They were just sent to us. You know, he was able to send us some things and not others. He was able to respond to TDOC's discovery request and not ours.
At least, I think there's at least like five motions he filed during this time.
Correct. He's filing.
This is after he doesn't have a lawyer anymore.
Correct. He's filing motions for restraining orders, motions for medical transfer, motions to establish conflicts of interest. He's filing an amended motion for a restraining order, a motion for appointment of counsel. He sends letters, a motion to amend, another motion to establish a conflict of interest, motion for order of protection. And some of these are handwritten, but lots of them are typed. Someone is typing these letters, and he's signing them, his signature on them. He's able to send all of the multiple motions and letters that are not getting lost in the mail.
He's also asking to participate verbally, right? Is that something that the other parties received? You know, if TDOC received that, did your client receive that?
I do not know if TDOC received that. We received the letters that he sent requesting that. It's our position, Your Honor, that a sitting for a deposition is obviously different from responding to written discovery, and that the appellees were entitled to the written discovery responses and a deposition at a later day.
Was there any indication to him that his request was not reasonable, that that's just something that you would not be able to, would not be acceptable?
I don't think that that was necessarily communicated to him, no. So to get to some of these other prongs, I do want to touch quickly on the saving statute. So there's a lot of discussion in both briefs about Bowles and Moore. Bowles was applying Ohio's saving statute. Moore was applying Tennessee's saving statute where this case is pending. Ohio's saving statute has a caveat in it that Tennessee's does not have. The caveat in the Ohio saving statute says that the judgment or decree, oh, I'm sorry, it does not apply when a case is dismissed on the merits. Tennessee's savings statute does not also have that same caveat. So Tennessee's case could be dismissed on the merits, as this one has been, because failure to prosecute is on the merits, but that does not preclude him from refiling without prejudice.
You can refile?
My time is up. Can I answer your question?
Oh, yeah.
I think that he can refile, yes.
And you would agree to that? Would you enter into an agreement, but agreeing not to raise the statute of limitations?
I need to discuss that with my client, but I don't see why we would not agree to that, because that we're not going to argue that the law says something that it doesn't say.
Why are we? Okay. Great. I appreciate your candor.
Thank you.
If you got that agreement, would we be done?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because
why not?
Because we still think Mr. Tarvin would have to restart his case, which we think is too much in this particular case. And if I can address a couple points.
Well, I guess I don't understand it. What do you mean? Like, he would, so you get an agreement, you can restart the case, he's got to file a new complaint. What, I mean, what's wrong with that?
So that the statute of limitations is no longer an issue certainly helps. It puts my client in a better position than he is today. And I appreciate the concession from both the state and CoreCivic on that
exactly.
point.
I mean, she can't make
we'll
that.
Talk to her client and exactly.
But why is that not, I mean, I don't know why that wouldn't take care of it.
Because Mr. Tarvin would have to restart this litigation that started in 2018. So we think it is a waste of both Mr. Tarvin's time and the court's time. And if you look at Allen and Cox, right, dismissal without prejudice is still too harsh a sanction when you don't have the fault in the other factors here. And if I can address just a couple other points that were raised by my opponent, in terms of the motion to compel.
The court envisioned his time might be called upon again because it dismissed the case without prejudice. So the district court envisioned that the case might be refiled in some form.
But we don't know how the district court would have ruled on the statute of limitations issue if it were raised.
Well, true, but if you're worried about encroaching on his time, it suggested that may happen again, and your friend on the other side has at least suggested they'd be willing to discuss that issue.
So that issue, again, would help us, but we don't have necessarily instruction from the circuit or the district court that the statute of limitations wouldn't be a problem. And we still think that restarting litigation after 2018 is way too harsh a result, given the conduct that we have here. When it comes to the motion to compel, Mr. Tarvin didn't miss that deadline. The court granted the motion to compel 2 days after it was filed and has a footnote talking about how it's not going to wait for Mr. Tarvin to respond. In terms of the efforts from CoreCivic, they at most wrote 2 letters, right? That can't rise to the level of prejudice for 2 reasons. One, Mr. Tarvin's made clear he can't read those letters. And second of all, as Schaefer advised, only minimal efforts doesn't get you all the way to the prejudice prong, right? You need more. And here you have at most, right, filing motion to compel, a motion to dismiss, and following up in written correspondence, which Mr. Tarvin cannot read.
Well, I mean, they also had to amend the scheduling order, didn't they?
They moved to amend the scheduling order.
They were going to take his deposition in August, and they couldn't do it because they didn't have his discovery responses, right?
Partially because they did not take him up on the offer to provide those orally. But even if you take that into account.
Again, I don't know that you're obliged to do that. I mean, especially since he seems to be able to do things in writing. So I'm not, I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that you're prejudiced if you're delaying the case like that. That's prejudice. I mean, I understand. I don't know how much money it's costing, but it's costing some money.
Two points on that, Your Honor. First, what Schaefer advises is that the prejudice has to come from an effort in pursuit of cooperation, which we don't believe that we have here, right? The CoreCivic admits in their certificate of service on the motion to compel that they did not meet and confer. They have a line in one of their letters that's saying, this is going to stand in for our meet and confer requirement. You don't have that predicate cooperation. I realize I'm out of time. Can I keep answering? The other thing is CoreCivic never pleads prejudice. So if we look at the Carpenter case, where there was no evidence put forth by the moving party of prejudice, there should be no finding of prejudice. And finally, this court additionally abused discretion by dismissing as to the Tennessee Department of Corrections, who never pled any prejudice, admits in their brief they weren't prejudiced, never moved to dismiss, and is not here today.
Judge Nalbandian did his best to broker a deal. I think he got part of the way there. Is this a case that you think would be helped by talking to the mediator to see if there's a way to resolve some of these things?
This case has not before been to mediation. I think Mr. Tarvin would appreciate the opportunity to talk to his opponents further. I'd have to talk to him, but I'm not going to represent that we would foreclose mediation because I don't think that I can do that without talking to my client. But Mr. Tarvin's looking for ways to participate and get the relief that he desperately needs. Thank you.
Thank you to the parties, and thank you, Mr. Brown, for representing your client pro bono. But it's a great service to the court, so we appreciate that. With that, the court may call the next case.